Hi, everyone. Welcome to Waste 360's Nothing Wasted podcast. On every episode, we invite the most interesting people in waste, recycling, and organics to sit down with us and chat candidly about their thoughts, their work, this unique industry, and so much more. So thanks for listening and enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Waste Expo 2022. It's my pleasure to kick off this CEO spotlight today and introduce our two speakers. My name is Don Ross, and I'm the chairman of the Board of Trustees for the National Waste and Recycling Association, and I'm the vice president of sales for New Way Trucks. It is my pleasure today to introduce Mr. John Vander Ark. John is president and chief executive officer of Republic Services Incorporated, an industry leader in environmental services. John is responsible for leading the company's strategy of sustainably handling customers' environmental service needs. Representing over 35,000 employees across the United States, John is also charged with advancing Republic's commitment to an inclusive and diverse culture. John received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Calvin College and a Juris Doctorate from Harvard Law School. It is also my pleasure to introduce Mr. Daryl Smith. Daryl is president and chief executive officer of the National Waste and Recycling Association. Without further ado, please welcome John and Daryl.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us. And it's quite an honor to speak to John today. And we try to learn a little bit more about him and talk to him about his leadership style and that kind of thing. And let's get started. So this morning we inducted Don Slager into the Hall of Fame and gave some awards to some Republic drivers and operators. So that must make you feel pretty proud.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Obviously, Don mentioned it. We start on the front lines of our business and work our way then up or back to the leadership team. But Don had a huge legacy, not only in our company but really the industry. And so. To see him rightly celebrated and put in the Hall of Fame was a real joy for the team.
Yeah, well, that's great. And I don't know if you guys know, but last year I had to interview on stage a Harvard graduate. And this year I'm having to interview a Harvard graduate. And, I feel like it's putting me under a lot of pressure to do this. So, I'm hoping we'll see what happens next year. But, at this point, I kind of think it's time for a Harvard joke. Is that all right with you? What do y'all think? A Harvard joke? So. All right, so here he goes. It was really hard to find one on the internet, by the way. It took minutes. What do you have if you have a Harvard lawyer and a Yale lawyer?
A lot of debt.
Yeah. No, what you have are two people that got accepted to Yale. Right? So it's actually a Yale joke. So I apologize to all the Yale graduates out there. So, John, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're fairly new in the position, certainly not new at Republic. What drives you personally? What's your favorite book? What's your favorite passions? What's your favorite child? Tell us a little bit about you.
So. Sure, yeah. No, Michigan born and bred. Then spent my college years there, went out to law school for a bit, then came back and was a consultant for about 12 years, served mostly industrial companies, so John Deere, Union Pacific Railroad, Daimler-Benz, and liked it, but knew I wanted to get an operating job someday, so came to Republic about a decade ago as a chief marketing officer, and then had a set of roles in the operations side of the business, being president about 3 years ago, and then became CEO last year. Listen, work is... a big part of my life, but it's not all my life. Mm-hmm. So I prioritize my life with faith, family, fitness, friends, and work. And that's how I've really organized my life. Yeah. So father of a 15-year-old and a 15-year-old son, 13-year-old daughter, yeah. Get to spend a lot of time with them and really enjoy.
What do you do for workouts? Tell us.
I am a CrossFitter.
So fitness thing. Yeah. Oh,
I
really?
I start my day at 4:43, Monday through Friday.
4:43.
I'm kind of a creature of habit and a routine-based person. Yeah. So I start my day out early and work out, and that gets me both physically fit but also mentally fit. And I think that's a big portion of your life, of you've got to stay healthy and organized, and you're whatever you're doing, you're running a marathon, not a sprint. So that's how I try to
Well, that's great.
Good start.
And I could not agree more, but I'm an afternoon workout guy. So, when you come in as a new CEO of anything, you know, you're starting to think about immediately about your legacy, you got to come in with a big plan, this kind of thing. So tell us, what are your primary goals? When you're in Don's position years from now, what would you like people to think about your time at Republic?
Yeah, well, listen, I'm blessed to have a great leader who mentored me and gave me a very strong starting point. Mm-hmm. So certainly come in with a lot of gratitude and humility, and had time to really spend with the senior team and the board leading up to the role, thinking about, hey, where do we go next? And so a couple big ideas we talk about. One is expanding where we compete. So environmental services, right, not just thinking waste. Historically, we were just waste, then waste and recycling. But we really think about environmental services and sustainability. That's who we are. That's how we define ourselves. And that expands our market and creates new opportunities for us to grow. Mm-hmm. And then we want to get world-class at three things. And we talk about it all the time. Customer zeal. So we want to be maniacal about serving customers. And that's a tall task. We pick up something 5 million times every day. So we've got a lot of opportunities to delight or disappoint customers. And so we think about how do you get into a zero defect culture and really provide world-class customer service, been measured against the best across industries. Think about digital, right? Mm-hmm. And how does digital become part of everything we do, the customer side, the operating side, and even the back office and support system side. And then sustainability. Yeah. And obviously we're a good actor. We get ranked in Barron's and lots of places in terms of our sustainability footprint, but we also think about that as an opportunity to grow. And how do we use something that really is a headwind for lots of businesses? It's really a tailwind for us to grow the business and create further returns for our shareholders that allows us to reinvest and then do better things for the environment.
Yeah, well, I was when you said customer service, customer experience, it made me think back. I don't think in the previous CEO interviews, anyone has put as much of an emphasis on that, and it's right on the top of your mind, obviously. What else can you tell us about that? Because I know there's a huge movement. They don't even call it customer service anymore. Customer experience. So, yeah. Tell us more about why that came up so quickly.
Yeah, some of it's where I cut my teeth. So yeah. I started out as a chief marketing officer, and I was the first marketing employee in the history of the company. So historically, the business had grown either through acquisition or the economy grew. Mm-hmm. And Don had the vision to say, coming out of the Republic Ally deal, there wasn't another big deal to do in the short term. So we had to get good at organic growth. And that's where I started. And I started with customers. And I started, did ride-alongs even before I joined the company with our salespeople, just understand what this was. And I remember riding in December of 2012 with a sales rep in Detroit. And we did a couple visits, and those went pretty well. And then the third visit, he said, hey, this customer had just taken a price increase. And, we had missed them a couple times, and I don't think we're going to be happy, or they're going to be happy. So we went in there, and the guy talked about our inflationary costs and what we do for the environment, and really did a great job. And the customer was having none of it. And he got his teeth kicked in. So we kind of limped back to the parking lot, and we're riding in the car, and I'm staring out the windshield and not even want to make eye contact, and he gets to a stoplight, and he said, John, it's really just a commodity. And that's what got me energized to join, because I instinctively knew that probably wasn't true, that we just hadn't really done a good job of differentiating the offering and differentiating the product. And so that's what we went out to do, and we surveyed customers and understood that most customers don't view it as a commodity. They care deeply about performance and sustainability and offering a broader set of products and services, and that's really what we've set out to do over the last decade.
That's awesome. So, the obvious question that's going to come up is US Ecology. And, it's not the typical acquisition that we see in the waste industry. And I know you're expanding more into environmental services. And that's, very interesting to me and very interesting to everybody, I think. Mm-hmm. So tell us what you can tell us. And I know I heard you were doing some town hall meetings with the new employees last week. And maybe tell us how that went, because it's a little bit different, skill set sometimes than what we're used to.
Yeah, back to strategically, right? We think our business has gone, more from a $67 billion market in North America to a $100 billion market in North America. And so done a lot of work on, hey, how do we participate in this space? And really it was customer-led growth. Our customers said, hey, we want a service provider who can do more we want you to handle all our environmental services needs. And they're about $1 billion business. We have about $1.5 billion manufacturing vertical inside our $12 billion of revenue. And there's a ton of cross-sell, tons of connectivity between those things. And we have a very unique part of our business, and I've served lots of different industries. I've never seen this before. The customers who buy more from us pay more per product. So the more somebody buys from us, rather than getting a discount for a bundle, they pay a premium for it. And the reason they do that is because we're actually a very, very small portion of their cost structure. And what they're buying on is the ease and the effortlessness of the experience. They're buying on being able to interact digitally. They're buying on our safety record and our sustainability footprint. And so that's what got us excited to, you know, bring these companies together. Lots of expertise on that side. We feel really comfortable with our technical expertise. And we do a lot of deals. We do 20 to 50 deals a year, and we're good at integration. So we closed the deal on Monday, and by Tuesday, we had teams across all of their sites across North America, Quebec, Alaska, all over the place, where anywhere they had a meaningful concentration of employees, welcoming them to Republic.
That's awesome.
And just letting them know that they're part of us.
And congratulations on all of that. And I think you know, people are going to be watching that very, very carefully with interest. And so let's change topics just a little bit. And it's something I've been thinking about a lot this year. Seems to keep coming up a lot. It's women in the industry. And since I've been here 5 years ago, I've been hearing this. We need more women in the industry. And we have, you know, NWRA has a very active women's council, and people talk about it a lot. And Republic was named 2019 Best Employers for Women on that list. But, you know, I think there is so much room still to figure this out, you know, and, you know, bring more women into the industry. So what can you tell us about your efforts there, and are you seeing any progress?
Listen, I bet my career on this topic. Mm-hmm. And so when the board first started having a conversation with me around potentially being a CEO candidate, they said, well, we want to hold you accountable every quarter, and what are you going to measure yourself on? And they said, you know, choose five or six things. And we have 170 business units that's our lowest level P&L. And our general managers run those business units. And I said, one of the things I'm going to measure myself on is the diversity of our general managers. That's what you can hold me accountable to. And over about a 2.5 year period, we doubled the diversity of our general manager ranks, and we're going to go double it again. And we're on the path to do that. I've got 7 direct reports. 4 of the 7 are women. And I didn't do that because I set out to have, you know, I wanted some targeted goal. I said, I probably ought to expose myself to half of the universe's talent pool. And if other people aren't going after that talent pool, I'm gonna get the best of the best. It's a competitive advantage for me. So that's how we do everything we do. We don't do things, you know, sustainability cannot be detached from business performance. Those things have to be connected and synergistic. And again, I did that because I thought it would make the business better, not because I had some abstract social goal.
Yeah, so how do you start? Like, if you walk into a company and say, I want to increase diversity, increase, you know, the various populations. What do you do? How do you just get started with
that? Yeah, listen, some of it is tactical, which is the female drivers. We have programs there. Well, if you don't have a locker room at the site for women, how excited do you think they're going to be to work there?
To start.
I mean, so there's some just basic mechanical things. And then you think deeply about community, right? You can't be what you can't see. And so do they have leadership that's diverse, right? If you're a female driver, do you want to be the only female driver? Right? Think about how that would feel. If you're a man, would you want to go and be the only male of a group of 30, 40, 50, 60 male drivers? Right? You just wouldn't feel very included. So creating community and investing, and when you kind of build that community, you get mentorship and people feel included and they feel connected.
Okay, well, let's switch a little bit then to your fleet. How many trucks do you have?
Oh, 18,000, yep. And I'd have to get the number with the Usticology.
Close enough. North. So, you know, talk to us about, you know, technology with the fleet and your thoughts on the fleet, and, you know, and it's, you know, primary part of your business. So I'm sure you have plenty to say on it without me asking.
Yeah, fifth largest vocational fleet in the United States. We started a program a decade ago called One Fleet. And One Fleet really wasn't about maintenance or cost. It was about customer service, which is you cannot pick up somebody 5 million times every day if the truck can't roll. And so that's what we wanted to do. And we went from really 20% scheduled maintenance, 80% reactive, to we thought the frontier was going to be 80% proactive and kind of 20% reactive. We're now 90% scheduled, right? So we have very good predictability in our fleet and very good availability. And we had to kind of overcome a bow wave of some sins in the past where we hadn't taken care of the fleet in some spots. We've gotten through that. And so now our maintenance cost is, you know, very, very competitive. Yeah. From a technology standpoint, automation, we're most of the way there. We've got another, we're at 77%, I think, on resi. I think we can get to 85. So we've got some more to grind out there. And then on the powertrain side, we're very bullish on electrification. Mm-hmm. I've talked about that a bunch, and we see that as a true zero emissions technology. And our industry being one that is an unbelievably good application for electrification. Mm-hmm. And so, listen, we've got pilots running right now, and we're going to get there at scale sooner than people think.
Are there any differences in your strategy in particular states with electrification, or is it just kind of across the board?
No, for sure. And so you think about, hey, where is our customer demand? Mm-hmm. And where is their state either penalties or hopefully incentives to get you there? And like most of the things that happen in our industry, right, innovation happens on the coast. So we'll go longer on California, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, Oregon, Washington. Those will probably be our anchor states that we start with. And then we'll kind of build out across the country.
Okay. Well, tied closely to your fleet is safety. You know, safety is the issue in the industry. You know, we're coming out of COVID. There are going to be a lot more drivers on the road. You know, teenagers that never driven before. All sorts of issues coming on. You know, and the safety wise, we're not getting worse. We're not getting better. Distracted driving is a huge issue. Tell us where you stand on safety. What are your goals? What's your philosophy on trying to improve safety in the industry?
Yeah, it's certainly we've just updated our values, and that's our first value is being safe. You know, not surprisingly, this is a very dangerous industry, and I think our behaviors are certainly getting substantially better as an industry. Yeah. The environment in which we operate is getting substantially more challenging. And so, listen, that's something that we need to overcome as a company, as an industry. We think about it in terms of multiple dimensions. So there's obviously behavior and training, and we've got very cultural on that front. I'd say, and technology on the vehicle. Certainly we've invested a lot in lighting and cameras and everything else. Where we're really going next is analytics. So we're understanding, okay, with 18,000 trucks, right, all those routes, where are unsafe events happening? Right. Well, they're happening, right, when drivers go from X to Y hours. Right. They're happening when somebody gets in a truck that they don't drive typically. They do a route that they're covering from somebody else. So where are the things that you can now structurally say, hey, this is a more unsafe condition. Now I need to step in as a leader, right, and try to arrest the trend here.
Right.
Spend more time as a supervisor with that driver, making sure they're comfortable in that truck, covering that route, making sure our hours don't get above, 52 and a half, we think is a sweet spot for us. Because we know above 52 and a half, we get less safe. Because you're doing something for too long and you lose your focus, lose your edge.
Yeah, I really like your focus on data. It can be, very helpful. My background used to be safety. When I was in the mining industry, I was playing around with the database that MSHA provides and found out that there was a remarkable number of injuries in the mining industry due to makeshift crowbars. And nobody had ever noticed before. And as soon as we announced it, everybody cleaned up, the mining industry of these makeshift crowbars. So you can find some very counterintuitive things when you start looking at the data. And I think everyone should be focusing on data too, because, like I say, we're not making a lot of progress. And that is if you just don't know where to start, that is an excellent place to start. Just start looking deeper and deeper and deeper as to what is actually causing the injuries. So talk to us a little bit about your thoughts on the new SEC reporting, that's coming along relative to ESG and the like. And, are you keeping your eye on it? Are you preparing for it? That kind of thing. So,
yeah, look, I think we feel very well prepared in the sense that we've got a great story to tell, right? We're doing the measurement and understanding our footprint and how we're impacting communities and safety and all of our sustainability goals. So we're not afraid of it. I think there's a lot of sorting and sifting that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. The winners in the short term may be Accenture and KPMG and PwC and all, you know, all the reporting that's required, just like SOX got pushed through, it just became a very big administrative hurdle. And so I hope there's a lot of dialogue and thought that we do this in a way that is relatively efficient, but there is a big need for standards, and so we're pro standards. You know, you think about climate leadership and you just hear people's goals around carbon neutral, zero carbon. You know, right now I'm skeptical of a lot of those things. First, because it depends on what baseline you're defining, and most of that is self-defined. Second, I see lots of CEOs make bold promises that they're going to be sitting on a beach drinking a cocktail someday, and their poor successor is going to have to fulfill that promise. So I'm into kind of real measurement, ratable goals. And listen, we want to put our money where our mouth is and make real progress.
Yeah, well, we're, you know, NWRA can be helpful in that regard, I believe. And speaking of NWRA, we're basically your lobbyist. You know, we are always looking for threats to the industry in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country and the states. And, you know, what are your biggest, you know, public policy challenges that you see them? And, you know, how can NWRA help you?
Yeah, I think, listen, things the industry can do a great job of coming together are standards. So think about climate leadership, right? The EPA model right now on how they measure landfill emissions is crazy. Right, the more gas you capture and you could put it into a renewable project, right, and be really good for society, you get penalized for that, right? Because that's the easiest way to measure it. I understand that, and the solutions aren't easy either, right? There's no perfect standard unless you're going to fly airplanes over a landfill every day, which we think is prohibitively expensive. So that's a great place the industry can come together and come up with a common set of standards, and we're better together on that front. Something like PFAS, right? Which again, if this industry didn't create that problem, we're catching it, right? But if it's poorly understood, right, we could be the ones holding the bag and get penalized for that. So getting very proactive to educate people and then coming up with some standards and approach for how we treat it, again, I think is a place the association can
That is an excellent statement on PFAS and other things. So, you know, it's NWRA's 60th anniversary, 60 years. And you know, we're doing a few things to celebrate, but we're more future focused than that. And you know, where do you see the industry going 60 years from now? What will we be doing? Automated driving, you know, that kind of thing.
I think we're at the forefront of a sustainability movement that is only going to grow in steam. And you know, you think about this business historically, people talk about garbage and waste, and they still talk about that. And I always reframe it around sustainability or environmental services more broadly. So I think there's an opportunity for us to elevate who we are and what we talk about. Society's asking questions of business, and they're asking questions around circularity. And rather than fighting that trend, right, I think we ought to embrace that trend. And so our last use for something is to put it in a landfill. People always say, well, landfills, that's where you make all your money. And I say, landfills don't pay us a dime. Customers pay us money. And customers are willing to pay a premium to do the right thing. And just to give you a very hard set of facts on that, right, we used to sell recycling to our open market customers, right? That used to be, you know, kind of at a 70% of the solid waste price. And then our portfolio was even worse, right? If I look at existing customers, we were like in the high 50% of solid waste. We now sell recycling at 130% of solid waste, right? And if you look at our portfolio, customers pay more for recycling than solid waste. And what do we do? That's a lot of hard work. But we moved it because we did the research and we understand customers are willing to pay more to do the right thing. And so when we do that, it allows us to generate more returns, which allows us to innovate and do things like the Polymer Center, where we're forward integrating into plastics recycling. That's going to drive more circularity, at least into PET and olefins, and we'll work on the other streams over time. So that's where I'd like to see the industry go in terms of thinking more proactively and progressively rather than looking back and saying, well, this is how we used to get paid, and so we get stuck in that model.
Yeah, well, I also really like what you said about, you know, always pushing back on everything. You know, it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction, especially for a lobbyist like me, you know, fight, you know, end any regulation you ever see. But, you know, there's a lot to be said for, you know, being proactive and trying to, you know, maybe not so quickly fight back on things. Maybe, you know, we did that with EPR. We changed our EPR position a little bit so that we're a little more accepting of EPR. And, you know, I would encourage everybody to try to think a little more proactively. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be defense, and NWRA can help with that. So would you guys like to ask John some questions? Mike, I see you nodding your head. This is a total setup. Michael, I'm sorry. He hates being called Mike. Michael.
Got a microphone here. Oh, hold on, Michael.
Find it just for the record. So.
Does that surprise you?
I thought you got your questions out yesterday.
I told a whole room of people you hate being called Mike, so, yeah. So you can't hold it against me.
There's absolute truth to that. So, John, one of the things you've alluded to several times through the conversation is about culture and people, but also underpinning it, I think, is communication and sort of delivering a message. And, you know, 35 years doing this, I think the garbage industry has tend to look inside and just do their thing and do it quietly and tirelessly. So where do you as a leader of a big company and then as a within the industry see how that communication externally needs to change, and what will you do as you're part of that?
Yeah, so we're just trying to get more connected. And so again, there you can have paid media or earned media. And we're relatively frugal, right? So we're never gonna have a huge paid media budget. And I felt that when I was our chief marketing officer, and Amanda, our chief marketing officer now, feels that as well. We play small ball from a paid standpoint, but from an earned standpoint, we have an unbelievably good story to tell, right? We are way more sophisticated as an industry and a company than people think. And so we spend lots of time with our senior team trying to get them out and connected. And NWA is great, but you know, American Plastics Recycling Conference. Like I mentioned yesterday, right? I showed up there to introduce our Polymer Center, and I was on the fourth day of a long trip, and Brian Bales dragged me to this thing, and I thought it was gonna be like 20 people in folding chairs. And I get in this room, there's 2,100 people in this room. And every major chemical company was there, every major plastics company, every major oil and gas company, every major consumer product goods company was there. And so we get up there, there's a stack of questions that the audience had. At the end of it, we had 50 people come up. 20 people said, I will buy every ounce of plastic that you produce out of that facility. And so I think sometimes this industry undersells the role they have in the value chain and the role they have around sustainability, right? And we think of ourselves in too small a terms where, again, there's a huge circularity conversation going on, and the long pole in the tent is aggregation. Well, who are the aggregators? It's everybody here in this room. And so our ability to get out and shape, but in order to get out, you've got to have a story to tell, and the story to tell has got to be a future-focused one that doesn't necessarily fight everything, but says understand strategic intent, right? Mm-hmm. Where's the regulator trying to go? Where's society trying to go? And how do we shape that in a way that's going to be good for everybody?
Yeah. And I'm not surprised the plastics conference was very packed these days. So any other questions? Front row.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Manuel Carmona, and I work for the European Union delegation to the U.S. Very interesting conversation that you're having. I had a couple of questions. One of them is whether Republic Services is active in the field of recovery of critical materials for the green transition. Whether you intend to, at the end of the day, there's perhaps some golden opportunities in waste to recover these very, very rare elements that are necessary for smart grids, for electric vehicles, etc., etc. Just to know if you're active on that. And second question is whether you're active in Europe or have relations with waste management sector and environmental services in Europe, which is a blooming businesses backed by the European Green Deal and the other policies that are now being put on the table by the European Commission. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, so in terms of, I think the first question was in terms of going and remediating landfills and mining materials, that we've actually had done that in a few spots. Now somebody's come to us and said, hey, we think there's some precious metals or there's opportunity. And listen, we're open to that innovation, right? If there's opportunities there and those they find the resources there, that's a great story for us, a great recovery. Again, we're renting somebody a piece of real estate forever. Right, and that real estate is precious. So to the extent that we can create more capacity and find other uses for things, right, that's our first choice. In terms of Europe, listen, we go to Europe, I'm going in a month. We are not going there to operate, right? We go there to learn and connect. The reason we don't go there to operate is, you know, historically a couple big players in the industry were there, and they found out the hard way there's not a lot of economies of scale of operating a global business today in a service-based business. Now, I don't know that will be true forever, because as the value proposition gets different, as there's proprietary insights around sustainability, right, around how you operate a fleet, right? The conditions of that could change over the long term, but we certainly go there to learn because Europe does a lot of interesting things and progressive things around recovery, organics, and different materials. I'd say this, you could go there, and the returns profile in Europe is about half of what it is in the US in terms of how the industry does. And so you can easily go there and be critical and say, well, they don't make any money, and so it's a bad idea. We go there with a humble heart to say, okay, there might be some interesting ideas there, and we found some. They just haven't found a way to necessarily get the economics to line up with the idea. And that's where we, I think, do a really good job as a company of saying, if we believe in it, then we got to fight really, really hard to get the economics to support it over time.
What are other questions? We have time for one or two more. And then John has to go along quickly to his next appointment. We'll get you next.
Hey, John. You mentioned customers are willing to pay more for recycling. You found that in the last few years. Are you seeing that on organics recycling, particularly in states where maybe there aren't policy drivers? I know you guys have quite a bit on the West Coast, but relative to curbside, it's still not at the scale.
Yeah, it's still early days on that. Listen, I think that's going to be the next big opportunity, right? 20% of what goes in our landfill is organic material. And I think there's lots of different innovation on the post-collection side. No one has really gotten that right, either from an economics or a performance standpoint, to be consistent yet. But I think that's a matter of time, right? I think that's where innovation will occur, and I think we're going to be having a very different conversation, certainly 10 years from now, but maybe as soon as 5 years from now, where organics starts to become more scalable. And again, like everything else, it will roll out in a state-by-state basis. The country doesn't move in a uniform manner, right? There'll be Minnesota and Massachusetts and California and Oregon will be operating at a different pace than some of the other states.
Those places are different, you think? So one more question. So there you go.
Thanks.
Yeah, our organization is finding that getting enough CDL, just enough CDL drivers, not to mention those people who are going to be stable, to create diversity and safety, safe drivers, that's been a really big problem. It sounds like it may be a challenge for you, and wondering what you're doing about that or how you're going about it, if it is a problem.
Yeah, we're certainly in a very unique moment of elevated inflation, right? Approaching really elevated inflation, and some tightness in the labor market. So this is certainly a challenge. I think every company here is would hire more drivers if they could. So, and we're in the same spot. I think we're better relative to most, but we've got plenty of work to do on that front. If you kind of turn the clock back though and think about, hey, pre-pandemic where we're at, people have talked about a driver shortage for 30 years, and I can bet you 30 years from now they're going to talk about a driver shortage. I don't spend a lot of time worrying about that for a couple reasons, right? In the macro world of drivers, right, our industry is actually a really small proportion of the overall driver population. The value proposition we can offer is a very different one, right? It's a home game versus a road game. Right, I think the pay packages here versus the over-the-road crowd, right, are really, really competitive. Right, the cultures of our company in general, right, treat people more as a part of the team rather than a widget moving a load from A to B. So I feel like our industry in general has got some advantages, and I think our company itself, we spend an unbelievable amount of time on being the place where the best people come to work. And so the culture, and we measure employee experience, and our employee experience numbers went up over the last 6 months because we've invested a ton in our front line. What keeps me up at night is technicians, because I think that is a diminishing pool in the United States. We've gutted vocational education for the last 20 years, and our industry has some challenges versus the driver's side, right? Because most of the technical work in our industry happens on the second shift versus the first shift. Well, the new generation of people coming into the workforce, they don't want to take that value proposition. It doesn't matter how much you pay them. They want to be home for their kids and at night to coach the basketball team or baseball team or put their kids to bed. And that's certainly a realistic goal for them. And you were competing with, John Deere and Detroit Diesel and Caterpillar and places that are paying real money, have unbelievable infrastructure investments in their facilities. So that's a huge issue for us. And we've said this 5 years ago, this is going to be an issue. So we've backward integrated into technical education. So we have our own center in the Dallas area where we started about 9 months ago with our classes, and we take about 20 people through a 12-week class. We pay for their entire schooling, pay for their lodging, and then we place them in one of our, you know, 800 dots on the map. And that class, is, that facility is now ramping up to 40, and it has capacity to go up to 100 people at a time. And so I think that's really what the industry is going to have to do is innovate. We're going to have to start growing our own technicians, because if you're just going to compete on the street, I don't think we're going to like the outcome.
Alrighty, sir. Well, we really appreciate you spending time with us today, and you know, we wish you all the best, and hope you enjoyed the show. And I would like to remind everybody to never call John before 4:43 a.m. in the morning. So after that, it's wide open.
Great.
So,
thank you.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's get our back.
Thank you for listening. It would mean the world if you would take a moment to rate or review this podcast. And if you share it with us on one of our social networks, we are giving out some fun, nothing wasted podcast swag. So just tag us and see what you get. Thanks so much.